Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We, as always, are live from Roberta's Pizza, and you are listening to The Farm Report. I'm Leah Eden. I'm a guest hosting for today. And this afternoon, we have Laura Ten Eyck on the phone. She's been on the network before in her capacity at the New York State Office of the American Farmland Trust. But today, we invited her on to talk a little bit about sustainable hop production in the Northeast. Welcome, Laura.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course. It's nice to have you on with a different hat today.
That's right.
So Laura and her husband, you guys are hop farmers at Heidelberg Hop Farm in upstate New York.
It's actually pronounced Heidelberg Hop Farm, but yeah.
Heidelberg, oh, okay. And you're working on a book about regional hop production. So we've got all sorts of fun stuff to talk about today. So before we kind of get into our region, the Northeast, our history with hop production, I'm wondering if you can give us kind of a quick understanding. I think probably a lot of our listeners are familiar with the term hops. Those of us who may have consumed a beer or two in our life know that there is some relationship there. It's the flavor agent. But kind of give us a brief understanding of what role the hop plant plays in brewing beer.
Okay. Well, you know, way back when people first started brewing beer, they didn't use hops. They used other types of herbs to flavor the beer. And then around about, 1100, 1200, they started experimenting with hops and found that hops have two things. One is they add flavor to beer, and they also are antibacterial, so they act as a preservative. And including hops in beer makes the beer keep longer. So this allowed people to start producing beer in larger quantities and shipping at greater distances. So it kind of gave rise to the commercial beer industry. A hop is basically, it's a vine. It's actually called a bine with a B because of the way it grows, because of the way it climbs. It's a little different from a vine, but it's basically a really big vine that crawls up high as it can go and produces a lot of flowers that look like little green pine cones. And those are the hop flowers, and it's actually the flower that's used in making beer. Inside the flower, there's a substance called lupulin. It's like a sticky yellow resin, and it kind of it forms underneath the petals of the flower, sort of at the core. And the lupulin is where all the properties reside that have the antibacterial properties and have the aroma characteristics and the bittering flavor that makes beer, beer.
Okay. So I want to get a little bit further into kind of where that hop flower comes from and how kind of, you know, you and your husband are taking care of it. Mm-hmm. But before we dive into that part of it, you know, you guys are located here in New York growing hops here. But that's somewhat of both a new and an old phenomena.
Exactly.
And so, you know, from my understanding, this region, the Northeast, used to be the largest hop producer. And then a lot of the crops kind of went through this disappearance, this destruction. Can you kind of give us a little bit of an understanding of why that took place? Kind of why did the production kind of come to a halt, and sort of where are we now in that change in history?
Okay. Well, you know, hops are native to the United States, in North America, but basically they were growing wild when people first came from Europe to live here. And when those people came, they brought their own hop plants with them on the off chance they'd be able to grow them and continue to make beer, which was obviously a really important part of everybody's diet, especially because they weren't really drinking as much water then because of purity issues. Because New York, being on the East Coast, was sort of where the European colonists kind of first settled, some of the really big hop farming naturally occurred out in this part of the country. And New York State was, by the mid-1800s, the biggest hop-producing state in the country. Of course, you know, the traditional home of hop production is in Germany. Anyhow, the New York State hops were huge, and they were supplying all the brewing in the country. And basically, hops have to grow in a place that has winter because they have to go into dormancy in order to come back and grow and produce flowers. So growing them like in the South wasn't an option. Late 1800s, early 1900s, the hop yards in New York State were dealt several blows. Two blows were through disease, basically powdery mildew and downy mildew are two of the big enemies of hops, and infestation started in the hop yards and weakened the hops, in some cases, you know, killing them, destroying them. At the same time, prohibition was coming into play, so there was reduced beer production going on, and as people were moving out west and had strongly settled out west, they began to grow hops in California and Washington and Oregon. And one of the things that really hops really don't like is a lot of moisture. They grow best in a fairly, I mean, they need a lot of water, but they can't be in a really humid climate. And so because there's parts of Oregon and Washington, for example, in the Yakima Valley, that are actually fairly arid, the hops took off there. And the problems with disease, because the area was drier, were not as significant. So they basically took over the market, and the hop production completely stopped in New York State, essentially. Although there were random hop vines continuing to grow, whether they'd gone feral from hop yards or people were just, you know, keeping them on, one or two on just for themselves. But basically commercial hop production ended at that point.
Right. So Laura, let's fast forward a little bit to kind of today, and maybe talk to us a little bit about kind of where the, you know, you and your husband are growing hops locally, and you're starting to kind of see some more interest in both regional and craft beers as well as, you know, regional hop production. Kind of bring us into today. Where was that trend, or where was that kind of impetus coming from to sort of bring back the northeastern hop production? And
sure.
maybe help us see that through your own story and kind of why and how you and your husband fell into to hop production.
Okay. Well, you know, my husband, his name is Dietrich Gehring. He's always been very obsessed with beer and the craft brewing movement overall. The hop growing has kind of returned to New York State indirectly as a result of the local foods movement, because everybody is seeking to consume farm products that are grown closer to home. The craft beer industry is really no different. And as they continue to outdo each other with really unique recipes and unique flavors, they're moving now into the frontier of wanting to have their beer produced with locally grown ingredients. Seeing this trend in New York State, Governor Cuomo passed a law, and the legislature passed a law called the Farmstead Brewery Act, where the production of beer is now considered an agricultural activity. So farms can brew beer, providing that a certain percentage of their products are grown in New York State. So that opens a huge door for economic development, which we're trying to walk through. Basically, the problem is a lot of people want to brew beer with locally grown ingredients, but the ingredients aren't really there yet, especially in any kind of volume. So people are starting to grow hops, and we are among those people. My family has an apple orchard in Albany County, and we own a section of that farm, and we've started putting in hop yards. There's a lot of other people across the state that are starting to put in hop yards as well in order to ramp up production. Barley, of course, is going to be another issue. That's another ingredient required, and there's not much barley being produced in New York State either. Our ultimate goal is to be able to have our own farmstead brewery, where not only are we raising hops, selling them to other brewers, but we're brewing beer ourselves.
Right.
And We've already started with a hard cider that we're using hops in. It's called Hopped Up Hard Cider. So that's kind of where we're at.
Okay. And so Laura, maybe kind of take us back, because, you know, it sounds like, you know, you and your husband have been, you know, beer appreciators and, you know, kind of looking at some of the book proposal that you guys were sort of taking this transition from being, you know, beer hobbyist to growing hops commercially. Talk us through a little bit some of those first steps. I mean, did you, when you say, you know, putting up a hop yard, what's kind of step one and step two of that process?
Okay. Well, when you decide you want to start growing hops, the first thing you have to do is get a hold of hop rhizomes. And what a rhizome is it's not really the root, but it's sort of an underground stem from which the roots and the above-ground vine grow. And they're available through various sources, but the idea, the important thing is to get them from a place that has them disease-free. And there's an organization called the Northeastern Hop Alliance that is working with New York State growers and growers in Vermont and New England to obtain disease-free rhizomes. And you get these rhizomes, and you basically plant them in the ground. And what you have to do is lay out a hop yard, which is basically a network of tall poles, because the hops need to climb, especially if you're going to be, I mean, they will grow on the ground flat out, but then you'll never be able to harvest them because they'll get tangled up with everything else. So they have to grow straight up. So the big part of, there's several components of starting a hop yard. One is you have to prepare the soil. You have to have the right pH of the soil and the right nutrients in the soil. Then you have to put up your poles and your trellis system, which is where the vines will grow. And then you put the rhizomes in the ground. And obviously you have to care for them and train them to grow up the poles so that you can harvest the flowers at the end of the season.
And so, Laura, when you talk about these rhizomes, like, what are we talking about, a seed like we would for, you know, any other kind of plant? Are we talking about like a little seedling vine? Kind of what does it look like?
Well, it looks like a root, okay? Mm-hmm. It looks like you dug up the root of a plant. It's like a brown, twisty kind of underground branch type of thing. That it has little eyes on it, sort of like a potato, and that's where the sprouts come out of. So basically, you can grow hop from seed, but it's really not done because hops don't grow true to variety. There's lots of different kinds of varieties of hops, just like there's lots of different varieties of apples, like Macintosh and Cortland. With hops, you have Cascade and Fuggle, for example. So, but when male and female hop plants pollinate, the seed that gets produced in the flowers isn't necessarily going to produce the same kind of plant that its parents were. So basically, people try to keep male plants out of the hop yard and propagate only female hop plants and do that only from the roots.
Huh. Okay. Well, we're going to actually take a very quick break. And, you know, we've put up our hop yard. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about what happens after you've put down those roots and kind of have you take us through a season. So
sure.
Stay tuned in. We'll be back.
Alrighty.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
right. Well, you are tuned in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are still live from Roberta's, and you are listening to the Farm Report. I'm Leah Eden. I'm guest hosting for today. We've got Laura Ten Eyck on the line, and we are talking about growing hops. So, Laura, you've taken us to the place where we have we've planted our rhizomes, and kind of before we get to the next stage, give me a sense of, you know, what kind of land, like how much land are we talking about? Kind of you know, what sort of the size of production that we have here? How many of these little rhizomes have you planted, and kind of where does that take you with the end result?
Okay, well, you know, because grow so high, I mean, they grow like 18, 20 feet tall. They don't necessarily take up a lot of room on the ground. We're talking about having, right now we have a three-year-old planting of 100 hops on a tenth of an acre. And we also have another half an acre that contains another 500 hop vines growing. So to get the full acre, we're going to be putting in, a full acre has about 1,000 hop plants growing on it.
Okay. And so you've sort of described this vine, and, you know, I haven't seen a hop plant, but I sort of have like a vineyard, in my mind to
yeah,
some degree.
Yeah, it's like a vineyard for giants.
For giants.
I mean, did you ever see Jumanji? The scene no. When the vine comes growing all through the house? And it's like this ultra super vine. That's what the hop vine is like. It's this crazy fast-growing plant. It can grow like as much as a foot a day.
Oh, my goodness.
And it becomes, not only does it become very tall, but it becomes very bushy. So, you know, one of the big challenges is once you get this sort of little vine starts to come out of the ground, and actually a lot of little vines start to come out of the ground, and what you have to do is pick the strongest, best-looking one, choose that vine to start to train up your trellis system, and then you cut back all the others and try to get the plant to put all its energy into growing this one vine. So basically it grows up a string that's hanging sort of suspended horizontally from the tops of the poles, from a wire, at the tops of the poles, and it grows up the string, and it starts putting out all these side branches, and those are where the flowers start to form, and that usually happens midsummer, and then the flowers become fully developed around the end of the summer, end of August, and that's when your real problems start, because now you have to pick them, and they're very high up in the air, and it's most commercial hop farms, big ones, have mechanical hop harvesters. So what you do is you cut the vine down and you feed it through this mechanical harvester, which has basically got these little rubber fingers that sort of strip the flowers off of the vine. Unfortunately, we don't have that yet, nor do most people in New York. Only a couple people do,
right,
because
we're
still in the infancy. So all those flowers have to get picked off the vine by hand.
Okay, Laura, and I want to talk a little bit about the harvesting because it's a pretty interesting process. But before we get into that, you kind of painted a picture of the what you're actually planting in the ground. But can you kind of give me an image of, you know, if I had like a hop flower in my hand midway through its season and then when it's ready to be harvested, what does it look like? What does it feel like? How big is it?
Okay, well, when it starts to sort of bud, but that's, they call it a burr. And basically it's like a little green ball. It's, you know, it looks sort of like a, not like a burdock, but it's about the size and shape of a little burr. And it, as it develops, it becomes longer. And the best thing I can compare it to is a pine cone, because the petals is sort of formed in the shape of a pine cone, where the petals, instead of, you know, being like a daisy petals, they really kind of lie flat along a central axis, so that it is, they're more like scales, if you can envision what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's really striking about the hop is the color. The whole flower is bright, bright green. Like a bright lime green. It almost doesn't seem like a color that could exist in nature. It's sort of a day glow color. And the petals sort of feel like paper, like tissue paper. And as the hop grows, the flower gets larger, but it also, the petals develop more. And when it's really ready to pick, it actually seems quite dry and springy. And the real trick is to pick it at the right time, not pick it too early. Mm-hmm. And if you miss your chance and it gets to be too late, it loses all its value.
So as someone who's growing hops, what are you sort of looking for to signal to you that it is that right time?
Well, this is something we're learning because, you know, we're not experienced hop growers. This is only our third year. And I think last year we ended up picking our hops too early. It's the kind of thing that it's got to be the right moisture, and there's definitely resources available to help you calculate what the moisture level is in the hop. But it's also very intuitive, where you have to be able to, it's tactile. You have to be able to squeeze it and sense the certain appropriate springiness and dryness to it, and then you also have to be able to smell it. And the hops have a very, very strong, you know, that smell of beer that's really bitter and strong, especially in the very hoppy beers. The hop flowers smell like that, but there's various subtle gradations of that smell. So you have to be able to identify the perfect smell and the perfect time and say, now it's time to harvest and not screw it up.
Right. And then so when it is time to harvest, tell us a little bit about, like, how they're harvested. What's that process from harvesting to selling to either, you know, a brewery or perhaps to making yourself? You know, are we using hops just fresh as they are? Is there like a drying or a process? What kind of happens then?
Like with everything, there's an array of things. Okay, when you determine it's time to pick and you pick the flowers, of course, if you have the harvesting machine, that's one thing. If you don't, you're just basically picking them off of the vine by hand. And then brewers will make a seasonal beverage that is wet, what they call wet hopped. So they can take the green hops when they're still moist before they've gone through any kind of drying or curing process, and they can use them to make beer. And it's called a wet hopped ale. And it's a really cool thing, and it's sort of highly seasonal and very fleeting. The thing that's tricky for the hop farmer is, in order to provide a brewer with wet hops, you've got to pick them and transport them quickly, because if they sit in any kind of quantity in any kind of a container, they immediately start to break down and sort of ferment. You know, like if you have a big plastic bucket and it's filled with hops and you've just picked them, if you stick your hands in there after they've sat there for about an hour, it'll feel hot and steamy in there. It's almost like trying to bale wet hay and put it in a barn. You just don't want to do it. So a lot of times what the brewers will do is they'll send their own people from the brewery out to the hop yard. They'll pick all the hops and they'll bring them back to the brewery and they'll right away make the wet hopped beer. For hops that have like a longer shelf life, they have to be dried. And that's quite a process in and of itself. They have to be kept at a certain temperature, like 120, 130 degrees. There's a lot of controversy about what temperature it should be and what the end product's going to be like, because different characteristics are enhanced or limited by drying conditions. You have to dry them, and then they can use them. Basically, you would put it in vacuum-sealed bags, and if you put it in the freezer, they'll keep for a long time like that, and the brewers can use them at any point. For really large-scale production, hop flowers, once they're dried, are sent to a pelletizer, and they're made into pellets, sort of look like rabbit pellets or grain that you would feed an animal. It's like a little green cylinder. And, of course, the really big breweries, it's not practical for them to handle so many actual hop flowers, so they work with pellets and almost exclusively. So for a hop grower to be able to sell their product that way, you have to be relatively near a pelletizing place and have your hops processed that way. But that's really more for larger scale production and not something that we're getting into at all on our farm.
Maybe a next stage of the plan.
Maybe. You know, and it even goes beyond that, where then they also reduce the hop to hop oils, and those are also used for various purposes in brewing.
Okay. Well, Laura, you also talked about how, you know, you guys are relatively kind of new at growing hops. You've been around for about 3 years. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, you know, especially for hop growers in the Northeast, since it is kind of a, you know, just kind of starting to pick up again. What are some of the resources that are out there or not out there? You know, I'm kind of wondering at what point you decided it would be, you know, useful to actually write a resource about this, to write a book about, you know, the history and your experience growing hops.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really glad you asked that question, because I want to give a huge shout out to the big three entities that are out there to help us hop growers who are new to growing hops in the Northeast, which is all of us, basically. And that would be the Hops Project at the University of Vermont and the people working on that. Cornell Cooperative Extension is also doing a pilot project at their research station, and their extension agent is involved in doing outreach to everybody. And the Northeastern Hop Alliance, which I mentioned before, both those entities are involved in that, as well as some other people who've gotten a head start. And it's all about sharing knowledge. And the people who know a little bit more, teaching those of us who are just starting out, as well as the fact that we're all kind of in it together, because even the people that know more don't know everything. We're sort of learning this from scratch. And some of the big challenges for us in the Northeast, as I'm sure you've noticed with the crazy weather patterns we've had lately with climate change, we're in a cycle of deluge and drought, basically. And the deluge part in particular really poses a problem for hop farmers, because when hop vines get wet, that's when we get disease and insect infestations. And we're trying to learn how to control those sustainably. And that's where we're working a lot with UVM and Cornell.
Right. Okay. And, you know, we're almost out of time, but
sure.
One of the things that I did want to kind of get a sense from you is what, you know, when you say sustainable hop growing, with the hop production, kind of what does that mean? You know, is that certified or organic? Is it, are there different kind of markers for hops as a specific crop?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, it's just like any other crop. I mean, you can be certified organic. You can use conventional means, or you can try to walk the line in between, using as few toxic things as you can in order, but still trying to keep your plants alive. And one of the good things about hops is a lot of the ways that you would raise them are what would be considered sustainable anyway. They really require a lot of nitrogen, and animal manure is obviously one of the best sources of that. So that helps a lot. And when it comes to insect infestation, one of the best means of controlling the insect infestation is through the beneficial insects that prey on the ones that are doing the damage. And so we've learned, you know, from the Hop Project at UVM that you can do a lot more damage by spraying pesticides to kill the damaging insect, because then you wipe out your whole beneficial population, and it's really hard to get back to equilibrium.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, well, I think that's that. You know, I think we could probably have a whole other conversation about that, and I think we'll probably have to have you back on when your book is out. When will we get to read it?
Well, it's going to be a while. I just signed the contract. It's being published by Chelsea Green, which is based in Vermont, and I know that I have to deliver the manuscript on December 1st of 2014. And then we go through the whole editing process and the design process. So it's going to be a while before you read the book.
All right. Well,
but
we're
going to learn a lot in the process of writing it and have a lot of fun.
Great. Well, we'll have you back on at that point and dig into the hops a little bit more.
Great.
Thank you so much, Laura. And thanks to everyone for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. This has been the Farm Report. This, like all of our 30 live weekly shows, can be found on our website, or you can subscribe via iTunes or Stitcher. And please, if you like what you hear today, consider supporting our network by becoming a member. Go to www.heritageradionetwork.org and click that donate tab. Tune in next Thursday at 1 for another episode of the Farm Report.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.